This is The Guardian.
This week, the world decisively entered a new era.
We weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal. I could have made a deal for Ukraine.
As the self-proclaimed king of the deal pushes for a resolution in Ukraine, it means huge decisions for us here in the UK and in Europe.
Europeans will have to step up, both in terms of spending and the capabilities that we provide.
So will a deal thrashed out between the US and Russia even be accepted by Ukraine? And what role will the UK have to play in ensuring peace in Europe? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. It's quite something to behold. Negotiations held in Saudi Arabia to end the war in Ukraine, with no Ukrainians present. Everything is seemingly being decided, so far at least, by Russia and the USA. And there's loud talk from Donald Trump and his colleagues about a new era of detente and even cooperation with Vladimir Putin. And here's another twist. It looks like enforcing any deal and peacekeeping duties will be the responsibility of European countries, where there's now widespread agreement about the need to massively raise defence spending. In short, we are in a completely new era. Patrick Winter is The Guardian's diplomatic editor. Hello, Patrick.
Hello there.
Let's start with big picture stuff. That's true, isn't it? We are in a completely new era here.
Absolutely. I think the last week has just been hammer blow to the whole post-Cold War era, and we are now entering a new terrain. But I think there's two things going on. One, people are still assimilating it and hoping it's not true what they're seeing in front of their eyes. And the second is this process of adjustment and where it's going to lead to.
Give me a sense of your own sort of feelings as someone in your line of work about that sense of sort of shock and disorientation. You must feel that on a daily basis.
Yeah, well, I was in Munich where the Vice President, J.D. Vance, gave this speech that shocked his audience, which is an audience of intelligence specialists, think tankers, transatlanticists. And it's worth remembering that during the first Trump term, the vice president who came to speak to this same conference was Mike Pence, who's now been cast into sort of outer darkness. And it's just a small kind of symbol of the degree to which this second Trump term is different from the first. I mean, I think people have tried to make themselves Trump-proof and had in mind what was happened during the first Trump presidency, but they didn't have or envisage, and no one had the imagination to envisage the full scale of the changes that have been wrought upon Europe in the last 3 weeks. It's just extraordinary. And I just, as I say, I think there's a real issue about assimilating the scale of what's happening and a disbelief that it's occurring.
And therefore, the disbelief might get in the way. Governments might be wrong-footed and slow to respond.
Well, certainly there's one thing about Trump is that he is moving at vast speed. One of his special envoys for Ukraine, General Kellogg, said, I'm working on Trump time, and Trump time means he sets me a problem today and he wants a solution tomorrow. By contrast, the European Union is a very kind of process-driven organization, and it just doesn't produce the kind of results. This is a one-person government in America, and the European Union and its relationship with Europe and America is operating at a different speed.
Talking of which, things clearly on Ukraine specifically are moving very, very quickly indeed. I wonder if you can just talk us through the last week, beginning with the news of Trump's 90-minute phone call with Vladimir Putin and what happened next.
Sure. Well, I think people were expecting at some point there to be a phone call between the president and Vladimir Putin. But what was not expected was that there was no forewarning of it whatsoever, nor was much released about the content of it, and that the Ukrainians had no advance knowledge and no member of the European Union had any knowledge. And one of the differences between the American president and Europe is that the president has absolutely no conception in his mind that European security is also at stake in what happens in Ukraine, and therefore he doesn't feel there's any need to involve Europe.
Just pause there. Just one question. In the past, whoever was in charge in the USA, would it be expected as a matter of political and diplomatic protocol that if a phone call like that came on the agenda, everyone or the right people would be forewarned? And in that sense, the fact that no one wasn't is further proof that we're in a completely new era.
I mean, obviously, America has acted in unilateral ways in the past. I mean, some of the withdrawal from Afghanistan was not widely consulted upon. Trump in his first term said he was going to withdraw troops from northeast Syria, and he hadn't consulted many of the troops from other countries that were in that area. I certainly remember, you know, very senior figures in the Foreign Office in the first Trump term saying they woke up in the morning trembling to see what was on Twitter. There is a lot of, obviously, a kind of sense that he doesn't always, or America doesn't always consult. But on a big issue like this, where there had been an expectation of everyone had an interest, therefore everyone would try to get their ducks in a row about what the negotiation position was going to be, they had none of that. They were given no warning and no consultation about what Trump was going to offer to Putin. And that was then followed on very quickly by the fact that senior American administration officials came to Europe for the first time, fanned out and started talking about there would have to be land concessions by Ukraine, and that there could be no question of Ukraine joining NATO at any point. And finally, that American troops would not be involved in any kind of security guarantees that were given to Ukraine in the event of a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. So those were three big steps that were sort of thrown at Europe, again, punch drunk by now as to what was happening. And then following that, we have this very kind of in-your-face speech by J.D. Vance, basically saying that European values as represented by the European Union aren't worth defending, that the country was, that, well, the European Union was riddled with censorship, fixed elections, and disinformation.
Yeah, and that European governments' own supposed political failures are, as he sees it, more of a threat to their countries than Russia or China, which is a mind-boggling thing to say. But anyway, we are recording this on Wednesday morning, and as you say, every day now Trump is back, one wakes up thinking, well, what's he said now? He's just said this.
And I think it's going very well. But today I heard, oh, well, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal. I could have made a deal for Ukraine that would have given them almost all of the land, everything, almost all of the land, and no people would have been killed, and no city would have been demolished, and not one dome would have been knocked down. But they chose not to do it that way. And President Biden, in all fairness, he doesn't have a clue.
Here's a question, Patrick. For an alleged master of the deal, as that sort of outburst or quotation, whatever we call it, reflects, he seems to be in a position of what I would call enthusiastic weakness, in that he gives it a lot of welly, but what he's doing really is constantly echoing Russian talking points. He's hugely weakened unity with Europe before the negotiations have even got going. So even if you take him at his word that he's the master negotiator, it doesn't look like that. I wonder, from your perspective, can you discern logic at work here in terms of the art of negotiating? Or is it as hopeless and hapless as it might seem?
Well, the question on everyone's lips in Munich was whether there was any method in his madness, as it were. And I mean, obviously, there's self-evidently there's chaos. But whether there's a sort of organized chaos or chaos for a purpose was the question everyone was asking. And one school of thought argued that actually the Trump team hadn't really assembled a policy on Ukraine yet. But then you have this line of argument that's coming from the White House, which is every time he speaks, it seems to be, as you say, agreeing with what Vladimir Putin is saying. And therefore you then come to think, well, if Vladimir Putin's interpretation of the facts are these, therefore your interpretation of the solution will be similar to the Russians.
God. I mean, that really, as the sort of central fact in this new era, is astounding, isn't it? There is one view of the logic at work here, which is that it might just be venal and driven by money. In other words, that a lot of this is about America's economic interests, hence the suggestion that the USA wants rights to Ukraine's mineral resources, which is a fascinating and awful story when one looks into it. There's a lot of lithium, graphite, cobalt, and titanium, all things that Trump wants. It's also a big part of why he says he wants to control Greenland. So clearly those things have to be factored in. They're important.
Yeah, I mean, if in the art of the deal, you throw everything you can onto the sort of bargaining table, and Trump's perception of everyone in life is that they have a price. And so he does always see all these deals, not in terms of values or freedom, he sees them in terms of what's in it for America. This negotiation was very swift about these mineral rights, and Treasury officials suddenly landed in Kiev with documents, quite long documents, setting out terms of a deal. And I think Zelensky hoped, since his bargaining position is not very strong, that he would be able to come to some kind of arrangement with the Americans. But his request stroke price was that there would be US security guarantees in return for handing over half the minerals that America believes are there. And then when he looked at the document, the security guarantees that he believed were going to be there had fallen away. Oh. So he simply couldn't say yes to that.
It's fair to say, isn't it, that a deal of some description will emerge from all this? And I wonder, therefore, what you expect it to possibly look like.
Well, there's obviously some aspects of it are there now, which is clear because actually Zelensky's conceded this, that territory that the Russians currently hold is not going to be got back in the short term. So that's one. Two, there's going to be, I think, an understanding, whether it's written into a treaty, that Ukraine must be neutral. And whether that will then also involve reducing the size of the Ukraine army and the number of bases, that those are the things that are in consideration. And the last thing I think is really important that's in play is whether there will be any European troops inside Ukraine, which will act as what the French call as a kind of reassurance that Russia won't start this again.
Well, so the broad picture, forgive me if this sounds trite, it'll be that Ukraine really, for the most part, is royally stitched up. And the one kind of guarantee that it has will be the presence of European troops potentially on the ground as so-called peacekeepers to reinforce the guarantees in whatever treaty is arrived at. That's basically the picture.
One of the issues at hand is that there isn't a consensus by any means in Europe that they have the capacity to send a large number of troops into Ukraine, even in this kind of reassurance role, some way from the front. And that if they do so, and Keir Starmer's made this very clear, there would have to be some kind of American backup because, A, that would make it more difficult for Putin to start fighting the Europeans. And secondly, I don't think the Europeans have the kind of military capacity in terms of air power to ensure that whatever force they have there is secure and is not going to be vulnerable to a Russian assault. And there could be no greater humiliation than Europe sending an inadequately sized force with insufficient backup and is then driven out of Ukraine by Russia.
And just clarify that a bit. Keir Starmer, as we both know, has said that in principle, UK troops could be put on the ground. Who else, European country-wise, would join in and who wouldn't, as you understand it, sitting here?
Well, that's what was beginning to be discussed in Paris at this hastily assembled summit, where I think the consensus was, yes, we can put some troops in, but we don't really want to go into it into great detail at the moment because it's going to scare the electorates. But we do, if we do so, we do need some kind of American help in that.
What would happen if those troops are there and they were attacked accidentally or deliberately by Russia, as you understand it? They must be the sort of scenarios that are being quietly discussed behind the scenes.
Of course they are. I mean, that would be the absolute central issue, is kind of what kind of mandate would this force have and whether there would be enough in the peace treaty for there to be clear assurances that Russia would not do this again. And then you come down to an issue of whether you trust Russia or not. And I mean, given the kind of British experiences and beliefs about the way in which the Russian Empire is a revanchist empire and that it wishes to restore spheres of influence and that this is just the beginning, it becomes difficult for the UK to ride these two horses to say, this is the nature of the Russian regime, but we think we can trust them and we can put some forces into Ukraine to defend Kiev, etc. So that's the kind of tension that's going to be within the kind of British debate.
You've mentioned already the prospect of Keir Starmer trying to persuade Donald Trump to maintain US influence and military involvement as far as Ukraine is concerned. Is that realistic, do you think, that idea of a bridge? Or do you think we're going to reach the point quite soon where the impossibility of riding these two wildly divergent horses, you know, being Emmanuel Macron's friend while also being Donald Trump's friend, is just going to become impossible?
Well, we're certainly doing the splits. I think if we'd really want to go back to this, which is a very tired metaphor about the bridge that is sort of gone out the window and it's foolish. And I can understand why the Prime Minister's sensible to say that we don't have to choose between Europe and America, but there may come a point where that becomes impossible.
And when is that? Give me an idea of what the wider factors might be.
Well, if he ends up having to agree to a deal which dismembers Ukraine, that is going to be very, very difficult. I think it's going to be very difficult if there are trade negotiations in which the UK can't extricate itself from tariff penalties from America. And then I think there's going to be difficulties still ahead about what role the UK could play in Southeast Asia. There may come a point of tension between Britain and America about how to approach China.
Last question from me. How much in the conversations that you have with politicians, people working behind the scenes in diplomacy at the moment, do you pick up cold fear? How scared are people?
I think that's the point I'm just trying to make earlier on, is there's a kind of disbelief about what's happening and a desire to hope it will go away. And that's quite understandable. It's a kind of human reaction to when something horrific is happening. But every day, what's unfolding in front of their eyes is genuinely frightening, and that all their assumptions, which diplomacy has been built, are crumbling. Stilts, if you want, of the bridge have been detonated.
Okay, on that note, we can agree that this is moving in such fast and chaotic ways that you will be back very soon. Thank you for joining us, Patrick.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Right, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be joined by Gabby Hinsliff, and we'll be talking about what all of this chaos and fear means for the UK. Welcome back. To talk about what all this means for UK politics, I'm now joined by The Guardian columnist Gabby Hinsliff. Hello, Gabby.
Hello, John.
Let's talk about Keir Starmer and the pros and cons of his position on this. As we both know, somewhat alarmingly, arguably, he's talked about agreeing in principle with the idea of UK troops perhaps undertaking peacekeeping duties in Ukraine once this deal, whatever form it may take, is agreed. He's speaking the language of steadfast support for Ukraine in the midst of all this. What do you think that means for him politically, both potentially positively and negatively? I guess it gives him a bit of definition, which he's been rather lacking since he took over.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are, for a start, there are very pragmatic reasons for doing this that are not about how it looks domestically. I mean, there is essentially a vacuum, not just a vacuum in kind of provision of manpower and kit in Europe if America's withdrawing from it militarily, but there's a vacuum in command. There's a literal vacuum in the command structure. We are probably the only country in Europe that has both military power and prowess and political stability. You know, we're not France, who seems to be reassembling its government on a 6-monthly basis. So we're kind of the obvious people to step forward at this point. How that looks back home, I think, depends on how much it costs, and that's something we might go on to in a minute. But there is probably, you know, there's a little thing there perhaps for pro-European Labour voters. It feels like wrong to talk about a silver lining to a cloud like this, because it sounds naff, but it is in some ways comforting, I think, maybe to find ourselves back within Europe at this point.
Although, as I said to Patrick Winter in part one, there clearly is a frightening aspect to senior politicians, in this case Keir Starmer, talking about involving UK troops on the ground in enforcing or policing a peace deal with Russia, right? There are risks politically involved there. It's quite a sobering proposition, to say the least.
There are risks. And it is, when you say sobering, I mean, it's hard to underestimate, I think, what a serious moment this is for us.
Really serious?
Yeah. I mean, it's an inflection point, not just in the life of this government, but the life of this country. It's the equivalent of 9/11 or the pandemic or the banking crisis. It's one of those, I mean, it seems silly to say one of those once in a generation moments, because they seem to come around about every 3 years at the moment. But it is genuinely one of those. If you step back from a minute, what we're talking about at the sort of ultimate end of this, if it all goes terribly wrong, what we're trying to prevent is a hot war between two nuclear powers in Europe. And that's a challenge to what's still a very new government that's still finding its way, that's had enough difficulties on the domestic front, never mind having this great overarching challenge landed on us. But that's the moment. You know, Keir Starmer either rises to it or he doesn't.
Everything you have just said in the last 3 or 4 minutes is crystallised by this push happening across Europe and happening very, very visibly in Britain to increase defence spending, to fill the gap left by a retreating or withdrawing USA. Labour have pledged to raise defence spending as a proportion of GDP to 2.5%. The noise on that, as we both know, is now getting deafening. When do you think that'll come into play as something's very hardened to be talked about politically and sort of in train?
I mean, the theoretical answer to that is that's what the Strategic Defence Review currently underway in the Ministry of Defence is meant to be doing. It's meant to be sort of charting a way to 2.5%, and that's meant to come out in spring. I think it's being now overtaken almost by the question of, is 2.5% enough?
It has.
2.5% just brings us back up to where we kind of ought to be. It's not taking us into a sort of new league that we might need to be. People are talking about 3%. Where do you find that kind of money? And I don't think you find it from spending cuts. I'm not even sure you find it from tax rises, although this makes it even more likely that the tax burden goes up and that Labour does end up having to break personal taxes.
Well, so what happens? We say this is a major inflection point for the world, and we're going to have to sideline all our anxieties about borrowing money, because that's just what we're going to have to do.
In the same way as we did during the pandemic, we effectively said, look, you know, this is a moment when all the rules have changed and, you know, we don't operate by the normal constraints. We just find ways of doing what we have to do and worry about it afterwards. So conversations in the EU are around, you know, things like issuing war bonds, or do we set up some kind of like international rearmament bank? It's a leap of imagination that's needed, that's more than just, you know, oh God, we've got to find this from within existing budgets. If you're talking about the kind of transformation that we are potentially talking about, you don't get that from moving a bit of money from here to there and maybe we can borrow from the contingency fund.
Okay. You say that, but there is a lot of noise around about the consequences of raising defence spending for other areas of government budgets, right? So Bloomberg this week reported that non-protected departments, those again, basically everything save for healthcare, education and defence, could be asked to potentially make cuts of 11%. Right? I read a column by William Hague, the former Conservative Prime Minister, in which he was saying, oh, we've got to cut welfare spending, that's got to be the first thing to go, look at the triple lock on pensions and so on and so forth. Quite eye-watering stuff, could be very politically dangerous for the government, but it's there, it's on the agenda, isn't it?
It is there, but I think this is a moving and evolving discussion kind of as we speak, because I think, are we really going to make between 2 and 11% cuts to sort of the Home Office, to Justice? You know, if you look at where some of those departments already are, if you look at what the domestic pressures are already on Labour kind of delivering on the things it promised it would do going into this election, it just doesn't seem feasible to me that you get it by cheese pairing other departments that are already on their knees. Something has to give. Either the scale of our ambitions has to give, and we say that we just somehow can't afford to invest in defence at this point. Or you say, if we have to do it, then we have to find some more imaginative way of doing it that we're currently looking at. And that's, and it's not very long to solve that question, I don't think. Even if you assume that negotiations between the US and Russia drag on for quite a long time, we have got some time to get our ducks in order and all the rest of it. This isn't something we can decide at our leisure over the next 2 years.
Do you think that says something about domestic politics, that an emergency like this will trigger this idea that being that hung up about borrowing and, you know, financial orthodoxy and so on suddenly goes out the window? And when you're faced with councils falling over or child poverty or the fact that people going hungry is now an ingrained part of everyday life across large swathes of the country, that never merits that response, right? And yet here we are and everything has to be moved for the sake of defence. I'm not denying the nature of the emergency in which we find ourselves, but that says something quite striking.
It is really hard to think that those kind of slow burn social crises don't get that same response, don't, you know, kind of somehow provoke the drop everything response, you know, and it's really grim if you're on the hard end of those to think, why doesn't anyone care about those things in the same way? And I think it's, we always say glibly that defence is the first duty of a nation state, but that's true for a reason. If you don't do that, everything else is for the birds, really. And I think that's why we're in the position that we're in on this. But again, you know, you draw the comparison back with the pandemic. When you see an existential threat coming towards you, things do change and move very quickly. And, you know, treasuries find themselves doing things that they could not have contemplated and would not have done in normal circumstances. You know, Rishi Sunak absolutely did not want to spend billions paying people to not go to work on a furlough scheme. That was against everything that Sunak in some ways stood for. But it didn't take him very long to come around to the idea that that was what he was going to have to do.
You don't think we might end up with a sort of very grim and extremely British position halfway between the two, whereby some elements of treasury orthodoxy will move? And there will be some extraordinary financial arrangements. But at the same time, something like austerity for large swathes of what the government does will nonetheless come to bear. It feels to me as if that's where we're going.
I think that's entirely possible. Or at the very least, I think if defence becomes the overriding priority of the government at this point, you know, that's got implications for everything else.
Right. Let's talk about what's happening on the political right. So in both Reform UK and the Conservative Party, for a very, very long time, probably reaching a crescendo in volume around the time of the American election, British right-wing politicians have talked in terms of Donald Trump being the bee's knees, right? And the idea that this is a kind of a political train that we have to hitch ourselves to wherever it may go. There was a big political event this week, in fact, which Kemi Badenoch and Nigel Farage both spoke. And that was its kind of tenor, the ARC conference. I can't remember what ARC stands for. Can you?
Alliance for Responsible Citizenship.
There we go. Yeah. So that, and that was the mood music there. It was definitely, look, to all intents and purposes, we're kind of British Trumpers, be they Tory people saying that or Reform people saying that. Now there, along comes this huge international emergency in which public opinion definitely seems to be against Trump and what he's doing. And there are a lot of right-wing voices in both politics and the media suddenly sort of taking fright. I got an email from GB News' press department today. Peace in Ukraine cannot be on Putin's terms, says Mark Francois, the shadow defence minister. Right-wing Brexit-y Tory politician, exactly of the sort you'd think up to this point was kind of pro-Trump. You wrote a column about all this stuff this week. Right-wing people were going, oh my God, you know I said I wanted this, but I really didn't think it was going to turn out like this. It's a somewhat crass reduction of what they're saying. Something is going on here, isn't it? And it's dangerous for Nigel Farage, potentially.
I do think if you break it, you own it, really. I mean, I think you can't spend years talking up Trump and years kind of basking in the glow of that whole American alt-right thing and then not be held accountable for what Trump then does in office. And it has been one of the rare unalloyed pleasures of the last week, there have not been many, has been watching Reform politicians squirm on the hook when asked about whether they still agree with all the things that they've said for the past 6 months. Ukraine's war has been something that people had close to their hearts. You know, it's something that's important to Reform supporters, important to Tories. There is shock and horror and a sense of shame at Ukraine being betrayed, and you know, reconciling that to the fact that it's being done by your guy is something Reform and the Tories are going to have to terms with now. But I think what struck me most coming out of that ARC conference was just the sort of sheer unseriousness of it all as a response to what's going on. You know, what's happening in the world at the moment is momentous. And you've got a bunch of right-wing politicians banging on about diversity policy and wokery as if that's like the great, you know, biggest threat to all of us at the moment. Literally, guys, we're about to send troops to something and it's not to fight liberal HR departments. You know, that is not the big issue here right now.
It's crackers, a lot of that, isn't it?
It is.
Kemi Badenoch said she was asked about Elon Musk's minions turning up in government departments and summarily laying people off, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency. And she said, the question wasn't followed up, but she's on record as saying that wasn't radical enough, which is mind-boggling.
Yeah, we'll be somewhat to the right of Elon Musk. That is not an electable position in the UK at the moment. And I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of anger domestically in the US. And I don't think we should be surprised that Kemi Badenoch is on the wrong side of this argument, shall we say. She's made a kind of pretty much set up a permanent home on the wrong side of the argument. But they have got 6 months of squirming to come at the very least, and they don't seem to have thought that through.
There's an opportunity here for the Labour Party, certainly, which, as we both know, is very, very worried about Reform, to really start to question that sort of staunch patriotic stance that Reform always takes. I don't know whether you saw that debate between Richard Tyson, Julia Hartley Brewer, that's the Reform UK politician.
I did indeed.
And the, let's be polite, right-leaning broadcaster. And she was making the point that Reform UK, like a lot of Conservatives, bang on and on and on about the integrity of borders. And yet here they are, and Ukraine's not entitled to any of that at all.
Which part of Britain would you give away if we were invaded and you wanted to negotiate peace?
None at all.
Oh, so we wouldn't give away any of Britain?
But
it's okay to give away a bit of Ukraine.
Hang on, it's not us giving it away, Julia, right? It's Ukraine, and Ukraine's got...
Ukraine doesn't want to give it away.
Of course it doesn't. But ultimately, as everybody said, it is Zelensky's decision, but ultimately... We've got to stop killing people.
She went for the jugular. You know, I think she was genuine in her support for Ukraine. And I think she's also representing a lot of talk TV viewers who feel that way too. And to watch Tice having a difficult time being taken apart by on right-wing leaning media it matters, because those are the programmes that reform supporters watch. It is important that right-leaning media hold right-wing politicians to account over this. And I think there is a gulf opened up between reform's leadership and its supporters, and to an extent between Badenoch, if she sticks to this position, and Conservative supporters, that the Labour Party should be absolutely hammering at the moment. You know, here we have Prime Minister is off doing the patriotic thing and talking about defending the West against this threat. And what are you doing? You know, you are basically sucking up to the enemy.
Yeah, yeah. It underlines what we've talked about throughout this episode today, which is the clear sense that we are in a completely new era. Thank you for joining us, Gabby.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do like and subscribe wherever you listen, and think about leaving us a review. It helps other people to find us, and we do really enjoy hearing your thoughts about the podcast. You can also get in touch by sending us an email or a voice note to politicsweeklyuk@theguardian.com. Our sister podcast, Politics Weekly America, will have more on President Trump's efforts to end Russia's war in Ukraine, as questionable and awful as they are, in tomorrow's episode. This episode of Politics Weekly UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Zoe Hitch and Nicole Jackson.
Hello, Grace Dent here with news. I've been cooking up fresh episodes of my podcast, Comfort Eating, and they are now ready to be devoured. I sat down with Gary Kemp.
I'd never seen fish undressed. The first thing I had to do was tell my mum I'd eaten raw fish. Oh my God, you'll get worms.
New episodes every Tuesday. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. This is The Guardian.